Welcome back to the last half hour of Issues Etc. It's our Religion Roundup. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We talked with him earlier this afternoon. He joined us from France. He's a religious affairs correspondent for United Press International, covering the gamut of things that he writes about in the course of the average month. For those of you who've missed these Religion Roundups, here's your opportunity in the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. We began by talking about a very timely news item, but with an angle that is kind of unique to Uwe and to Issues Etc. as well. Yasser Arafat died, of course, and people have talked about the political and the geopolitical ramifications of that significant death. I'm curious, what did Yasser Arafat believe? That's how we began our conversation with Uwe Simonetto. I began by asking him, what does the evidence tell us about Yasser Arafat's faith, if any?
Yeah, well, this is most extraordinary. I mean, Yasser Arafat was in bed with the fiercest atheists in the Cold War, you know, Brezhnev of the Soviet Union, Honecker of East Germany, Husak in Czechoslovakia. Then, you know, he runs around with the Muslims, which, of course, he used to be. He was actually brought up, when he was brought up, he was one of the great followers of the then Grand Mufti of Jerusalem during World War II, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was was very close to the Nazi regime in Germany. Then, when the Soviet Union collapsed and communism collapsed, he said, told everybody how close he was to Christ, and he had a dream, and that a lamb led him to Bethlehem, and here he saw the Virgin Mary holding Jesus, and he kissed Jesus. And then, of course, he always attended Christmas Mass in the Nativity Church and allowed his wife, who was a convert from Catholicism to Muslim, but who still attended Catholic Mass, to do so and actually have their child baptized. And, of course, when you really come down to the long and short of things, he was actually a supporter, because he named the current Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. This whole gang, the ecclesial establishment of Jerusalem, I'm talking about Muslim ecclesial establishment, they all want to establish a new caliphate. In other words, a Muslim religious empire run out of Jerusalem.
So we've got atheist, we've got perhaps Muslim, perhaps Christian. Where do you think the best evidence points when asking the question, what was Arafat's faith?
Oh, I think he was a totally fraudulent guy. He was anything, but I am quite sure his actual faith was a pan-Arab nationalism faith, in secular terms, obviously, a nationalism with some Muslim overtones. He couldn't have been really a bona fide Sunni Muslim, as he claimed he was, because, I mean, he ran around, he ran with a Christian crowd, he ran with other people, he went to church. All these things, of course, you cannot do if you're a convinced Sunni Muslim, because, they have a different theology.
You end your column on this question by quoting Arafat at a meeting of top Fatah leaders, where he said, quote, "Do not pay attention to what I say in the media or public appearances. Pay attention only to written instructions you receive from me." How close does this come to answering the question that you raise in that column?
Well, that's precisely what it is. I follow my own agenda. I say whatever I want to say, whatever I find opportune at any given moment. In my instructions, you get the real me. And that's basically what it was. I mean, I find it, being in France right now, just to add to this, I found it outrageous that the president of France, when he accompanied Arafat's coffin, but this is the same president who, while he was in the States, would not come to President Reagan's funeral recently. It is one of the most. I've known about Arafat. I think he was one of the phoniest figures around.
And briefly, since we have you on this subject,
yeah.
Does Arafat's death and the change of power in the Palestinian organization, does it make more likely or less likely a Palestinian state?
Todd, I wish I could answer that question. I can't, simply because you've seen, obviously, by the papers that that the radicals are also trying to vie for, are also vying for a succession. Yes, if the moderates win out, then it would help. But you might also find that the radicals win out and it will not help. I can't predict it. I'm not there, and I'm not clued into the current power structure down there.
We always take the opportunity when we have you, Uwe, to talk about the Pope. He is now 84.
Right.
He seems to, every time the cork goes under the water, bob back up again. What's the latest with the pontiff?
Yeah, well, he's absolutely amazing. Here's this guy. Everybody is predicting his demise. In fact, I've just written a piece again today as a sort of year-ahead piece. And he pops up again. He sits there. He writes on several books at the same time in Polish and then again in Latin, even though he can barely speak. He certainly is directing policy in Rome together with Cardinal Ratzinger. He most certainly is very, very good at trying to reconcile with the Eastern Church, especially with the Patriarch in Constantinople, now Istanbul, but Bartholomew the First. Trying to fulfill his life's ambition, which is to reconcile the Eastern and the Western Church, and after that maybe Protestantism and Catholicism, but I mean, it's the first thing is that. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. And, of course, living as a true disciple. In other words, he doesn't come down from the cross. He'll suffer. And he, therefore, has this incredible following among young people, not just Catholics. I mean, here in France, he'll be, God willing, in Germany in August for the World Youth Day, and you'll have at the final service 800,000 to a million young people attending that mass. This is unique in church history.
Do you think that the public is becoming accustomed to the idea of a pope who may not be able to make it entirely through a mass, a public mass, because of his infirmities now, may not be able to make it entirely through a homily because of this. And this is becoming, rather than something that people say, wow, what's going on and how long will he last, this is simply the way the papacy is now being conducted by this pope in his latter years.
Well, I think what the public see, and the public are actually quite smart in that respect, they see a guy who by his own example lives the life of a Christian and lives the life of discipleship. And everybody knows that the homily that is being delivered, even if it's not believed, if he doesn't do it himself, comes from his own plume. The public understand what he is trying to do. It's the same thing that why does he create so many saints and then what have you. It is simply to set examples to a totally disjointed society. I think that is being understood. I mean, I at least give him all my respects possible, because I think he's an absolutely unique figure in world Christendom, I think in 2,000 years of church history.
He was visited, Pope John Paul II was visited by the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew I, and the Pope returned some relics. Tell us about those and why this was a significant gesture.
Returned these relics that originally belonged to, Eastern, although the church in those days was not divided, but Eastern church fathers, and what is important is that the Pope makes it very, very clear to the Eastern Church, we want we want back, we want to be united again. He has not been very successful in doing this. When he returned an icon to the Russians, for example, but then the Russian Church is a particular problem, as you know. It's very nationalistic, and there are issues between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Uniate Russian Catholic Church, and all these things. Whereas it seems that the patriarch, ecumenical patriarch of Constantinople, who actually has no problems really. I mean, about 3,500 monks. That's about it. But who is still considered the first among equals among the Eastern Church's patriarchs, being the patriarch of Constantinople. And he made it very clear that he found this a great gesture of reconciliation, and he seems very eager to reconcile.
What are the real problems that remain between Rome and the Eastern Church?
Well, the real problem is Rome's claim to supremacy, and which the Eastern Churches will not accept. The Eastern Churches are prepared, as indeed are some Protestant churches, to accept the Pope as the first among equals, but still equals, that is, not the supremo of the Christian Church. And that has to be resolved. I suspect this is in the works, but this is my personal suspicion, because otherwise, the Romans know damn well that that they have to do that in order to, as the Pope says, have the Church breathe with its two lungs again, the Eastern and the Western.
You talk in one of your columns about Roman unilateralism, and this is something that I have noticed, that the Roman Church is often quite content to begin ecumenical steps with churches,
right,
under the assumption that this is really going to lead these other churches, these estranged brethren, back into the Roman fold.
Yeah.
Is that a big assumption to make with the East here?
Yeah, well, there seems to be that tendency. The Roman unilateralism, it's a basic assumption, we speak for all. I mean, in this particular case, it is the reconciliation between the Nestorian Church and the Church of the East in Assyria, or now Iraq and beyond, and Rome. The Nestorians have been condemned by the Universal Church, East and West, because in those days, well, they weren't divided. So Rome unilaterally says, well, it's over, we have intercommunion, and we get on very well. Whereas the Orthodox say, now, hey, wait a minute, we were involved in that game too, and we condemned the Nestorius for saying that that there were actually two Christs in one person. And so that was a heresy. Well, don't you think we ought to have a say in this matter? That is a typical example for why Eastern Orthodoxy gets quite annoyed. Those days, well, they weren't divided. So Rome unilaterally says, well, it's over, we have intercommunion, and we get on very well. Whereas the Orthodox say, now, hey, wait a minute, we were involved in that game too, and we condemned the Nestorius for saying that that there were actually two Christs in one person. So that was a heresy. Well, don't you think we ought to have a say in this matter? That is a typical example for why Eastern Orthodoxy gets quite annoyed.
We're talking with Uwe Simonetto, Religious Affairs Editor for United Press International. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. Uwe, you've also written recently about a non-binding congressional resolution being proposed by a House member from California pertaining to Saudi Arabia, Mecca, and Muslim terrorists. Tell us about it.
Yeah, now here's this is a marvelous. Here's this this great, is a congressman from California, Dana Rohrabacher, and he's a Republican, and he's a quirky guy. I'm very fond of him. He's a marvelous guy. He actually puts the finger right where it belongs, you know, and he says, well, wait a minute, you know, out of these, all these terrorists who flew those planes into the World Trade Center and into the Pentagon, most were Saudi Arabia, were Saudis. So the Saudi Arabian dynasty lives on a on the basis of, arrangements with Wahhabi Islam, which is this hard-nosed type of Islam that you have only in primarily not only but primarily in Saudi Arabia and neighboring states, who are really the source, or which is the source of, present-day terrorism. Osama bin Laden belongs to that sort of thing. So, you know, here we have Mecca and Medina, the two holiest places of Islam. Why not just go around and say, okay, if you are a true Muslim, you go, but if you are a terrorist, and if the Muslims mean what they say, that terrorism is not true Muslim, true Islamic, then they should not be allowed to enter these holy places. And technically, of course, this is quite possible. The Saudi intelligence service is good enough. But, of course, will they do it, I suppose? Not, because then it would mean a rupture between the Saudi royal house and the Wahhabi religious establishment.
You quote Ingrid Mattson, Vice President of the Islamic Society of North America, saying that what's wrong with this non-binding resolution in the House is that it assumes that Muslim leaders and scholars are not denouncing the actions of terrorists. Is that true? Have we seen real, tangible decrying of terrorism?
Well, I differ with Ingrid Mattson here. Ingrid Mattson is a convert to Islam who teaches what's the seminary? Hartford Seminary, in Connecticut, and actually is in charge of their chaplaincy program. And I differ with her. Yes, in the American Muslim religious establishment, to a large extent, or many of their leaders, especially Ingrid Mattson's group, the North American Muslim establishment, whatever it's called, yes, indeed, they are very, very clear in denouncing this. There are people in other parts of the world denouncing it, for example, in Morocco and in Jordan and others. But the outrage that you would find in an equivalent Christian setting from all Christian denominations, you will not find there. And if you carefully study, for example, websites of leading Muslim clerics around the world in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Iran and elsewhere, then you'll find that actually secretly they're supporting at least the ideology of terrorists, even though they're supporting those actions.
What do you make of the Saudi Arabian government's ad campaign that's been running for, well, golly, probably the better part of 3 years here in the United States? Kind of a tourism thing, but it appears to be an image-shaping type of an advertisement.
Yeah, well, this is what they do, and that is where they should put their money if they have to do it. But I think it's window dressing, quite frankly. If the Saudi government, I mean, I wouldn't want to be in their shoes quite either. They've made this deal with the devil. I mean, they've made this deal with the Wahhabis. If they get toppled by an even more radical group of Wahhabis, well, that's not going to be to the advantage of the West either. If they don't get toppled, they have to accommodate with these guys. I mean, they're between a rock and a hard place. But the reality is that they have created, Saudi Arabia has created the current crisis to a considerable extent, at least.
Speaking of ads, Uwe, the United Church of Christ launched ultimately a $30 million ad campaign with some television commercials that rolled out last week. And the biggest news about the commercials beyond the ads themselves was that NBC and CBS refused to run them initially because they said the ads connected race and sexual orientation as equivalents, and that made them too controversial. Your thoughts on the ads and on the media's reaction?
Yeah, well, first of all, there are several issues here. I think the most disgusting part of this is, I mean, if you see this, I've seen the ad. If you look at it, here are these bouncers, outsiders of traditional-looking church, and then they're selecting out like SS goons in Auschwitz. You come in, you don't come in. You go there, you don't go there. I mean, have you ever seen any church of any denomination, any normal church, be it Lutheran, Methodist, Catholic, Presbyterian, Anglican, you name it, where homosexuals are not admitted due to their homosexual orientation? It's another matter whether then they are allowed to, if they are members of the congregation and live in that lifestyle, whether they are allowed to commune. But to begin with, the United Church of Christ, which is a tiny organization, which has lost 23% of its membership in the last 15 years, is down to 1.3 million members. It's less than what in the old days constituted a sect, namely less than 1% of the population. Accuses implicitly all the other denominations of selecting out people because they are sexually differently inclined. This is so disgusting. I don't know why there isn't an outrage. Thank God some pastors and leaders of Lutheran churches protested against it, though not, for example, the ELCA leadership, which thinks it's ever too cute to do that sort of thing. There's nothing cute about it. I think it is just awful.
And
I'm getting, you know, as a practicing Christian and as somebody who is observing the Christian scene in the United States all the time, I cannot tell you how angry I got when I saw this thing. It's so phony and it's so false. And I just hope they fall flat on their faces with it.
Uwe Simonetto for our Religion Roundup. He's religious affairs correspondent for United Press International. And he joined us from France. Now, if you listen regularly to Issues, etc., you might take for granted the fact that Uwe Simonetto is with us as a regular guest. To have the kind of guest as his stature, tomorrow on the program, another good program, we'll be talking about the Kinsey movie with Judith Reisman. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.